Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back to CJ Evolution. I have a very special guest on the show today. His name is Justin Peck. He's a multi-time desert racing champion, successful business owner. But the most important thing that Justin did, I think, is write a book called Bulletproof. It's an insight to a life full of pain, struggle, and perseverance required to overcome it all. It's his memoir. So, Justin, sir, welcome, buddy.
Thanks, Pat. I appreciate the opportunity.
I know, man, and I hope you're having a great day. Can you tell us what drove you to write this memoir?
Well, the memoir itself was kind of based on just writing a legacy for my children. Mm-hmm. I had no idea or even desire to write something about myself to let the world see. And so it was, probably about 15 years ago is when my dad passed away. And then it really got me thinking, hey, you know, I mean, do my kids know anything about their dad? Mm-hmm. And then a couple years after that, my youngest brother, he overdosed on opiates and he ended up dying. And then it kind of really started pounding home of I don't have a legacy. I don't have anything for anybody to read about. And so, mm-hmm. It was kind of at that point, that part of my life where I decided to grab the pen and piece of paper and start writing down thoughts. And it took me about 6 years, but at the end of the day, I ended up finishing it, and it was still just the motivation of just keeping it for the children. And so, mm-hmm. I took it, gave it to an editor, and she looked through it. She kind of read through it. And a couple of days later, she emails me back and says, you know, like, holy cow, right? Like, this is crazy. This is, you know, this is really raw, and it's very honest, and it's very open. And this would be something that would be good for other people to hear. Mm-hmm. And I've been on the path ever since.
Now, you grew up, Justin, struggling with bipolar disease. Can you tell us about that time in your life and when?
Yeah. So growing up with it, I'm 43 now. I do remember my first manic phase. I was 13. Mm-hmm. And, you got to think that 30 years ago, I mean, bipolar wasn't even two words that you would even put together. It was a non-existent thing. Plus, if you look at mental illness, the stigma of mental illness is if you had something wrong with your brain, you needed to be locked up. Mm-hmm. And as a young kid, that was still, you know, pounded into my brain. And so I was always really, really good at keeping everything really private and really hidden. And so I went through, elementary school, junior high school, understanding that I was just a different kid. My mind processes were different. I would think things different than other people, or my friends. And so I learned, real quick to just mostly just rely on myself, mm-hmm. and to just keep my mouth shut. So, and it wasn't until, I was about 26 or 27 years old before, I had an experience that I went through that led me down the path of just kind of realizing that the mental health was there and had always been there.
Mm-hmm. Now you talk about, I think most of us know, what bipolar is, but you threw it out another term. I know what manic is, and I know you do, but can you describe what manic is and like a manic episode?
So the two forms of bipolar are the depressive, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, being down and, you know, not having any feeling of self-worth and, you know, having a lot of despair and no motivation, those type of things. On the flip side of that, there's the mania side, and the mania side is the fun part, right? That's mm-hmm. That's the fun part of the disorder. So, you know, I was always really good at making good, you know, a lot of money. When I was in my mania phase, you know, I was very creative and always had a lot of really good ideas. I started countless companies. When I'm in that type of mindset, and it's mostly because I have a lot of motivation and a lot of ambition, and I hear a lot throughout my days that. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that you can't, like, you can't start a company or you can't do this. And I like to prove people wrong. Mm-hmm.
And when you're in that phase, man, when you're in that manic phase, you're 100 miles an hour. I've seen people in that phase where, you know, it's like a drug, you know?
Yeah. Well, in fact, I mean, when I was 13, when I had the first mania episode, my parents weren't there. I was babysitting my younger brothers, and so my brothers had called my grandpa to come over and check on me because I was bouncing off the walls. Mm-hmm. And for me, I thought I was normal. I just thought that I had a lot of energy, and if you know, looking back at it now, you know, I understand more. But he was convinced, and my parents were convinced that I was on drugs, that, you know, I was taking some type of amphetamine, and that, you know, I was basically spending like crazy, and I just, you know, I wasn't. It was just my brain is wired just a little different than most people, and you know, it activates dopamine and activates the serotonin and just makes me spin pretty hard.
Now, did you ever, I mean, did your parents or anybody else when you were young, I mean, did anybody say, hey, man, we need to take Justin to the doctor and get him checked out? I mean, I know it was a different time, and you and I are pretty much the same age, and I know we didn't know a lot of this stuff, but did anybody say, hey, he's not acting like the other kids, let's get him checked out?
Well, you know, I think it's just like any parent, even back then, it's, you know, you've got a teenager, you know, he's a boy, he's mm-hmm. going through puberty.
Rambunctious, yeah.
Yeah, he's just, you know, he's going to be a troublemaker, he's going to do this, he's going to do that. And so, you know, I mean, we did go see some counselors here and there, mm-hmm. Just so my mom could have probably the peace of mind of saying, you know, at least we're trying something to find out kind of what's wrong with him, but at the end of the day, nothing really, you know, stuck, because here again, you know, when you're talking 25, 30 years ago, that those terms, you know, mental health, that was something that people just didn't talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you probably know this, Justin, because back in the day, you know, when you and I were growing up, you know, when they had mental institutions and they had places where, and those are pretty much phasing out. I mean, a lot of it's due to money, but you just don't have that anymore. So you talk about hitting lows in your life, and there was a time where you almost took your own life. What led you to that point in your life? Can you talk about that? I know it's probably difficult, but can you tell us about that point in your life?
Yeah, so I this was right at about the time that I started really researching kind of what was going through my head and why, you know, I had always acted like I had, you know, for so many years. A lot of the things that I always went through is, you know, I don't assess risk very well. Consequence to me, you know, I just, I have no concept of consequence.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was always that kid that, you know, if they were standing, like I remember at one scout camp, we were at Lake Powell, which is a place out by my area, and they had these big cliffs that you could jump off into the water into, and so we hike up to the top of this one, and the scout masters are down in the boat, and you know, we make it up to a certain point, and you could hear the leaders say, "Don't you guys jump from there? That's just way too high." And they, you know, the boys were, you know, kind of teasing back and forth, and it was always kind of a running joke of, if anybody will do it, Justin will do it. And so
don't do it, Justin will do it.
Yeah. So, you know, everybody, you'd get the kids that would stand on the edge and look over the edge and just, you know, they'd chicken out and, you know, do whatever. And I remember one kid say just that exact same thing. It's like, well, if anybody do it, you know, we'll do it. Like, I dare Justin to do it.
And it's on.
It's on. Right? Like, it literally was on. I didn't even look over the edge. I just stood up, ran across, and jumped off.
Jeez.
And so the crazy thing about it is as I jumped off, I realized, you know, right as you take off, I realized, I'm like, oops, this is a little higher than what I expected, right? So I hit the water. I did a little bit of the calculations and stuff as I got older, and I hit the water at like 87 miles an hour.
And that's like cement, man.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it really is cement. It was crazy. So the scoutmasters, they were very upset with me, to say it mildly, and so, you know, they wanted to know how far I jumped. So they took the ski rope, which was a 150-foot ski rope, and had one of the kids climb to the top where I jumped off. And, you know, they wouldn't let me get out of the boat. They forced a life jacket on me. You know, like, you can't move.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to stay here. And they took the ski rope and, you know, flipped it off the end. And I remember one of the scout leaders saying, "Let it all out." And the kid up top goes, "It is." And it was still probably dangling, you know, 25, 30 feet off the water. So,
jeez.
So, you know, I mean, here we are, you know, a 13, 14-year-old kid that's jumping off something that's almost 200 feet. And, you know, by all rights, I mean, it should have either killed me or at least hurt me really bad. But, but that was that. That's just been kind of, that's just kind of the way that the things have always worked with me. And so going through, you know, when I was 26, 27, somewhere right around there, I was on the other side of things, having kind of the depressive side.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was married, I had children. And so I woke up one morning and I leaned over and kissed my wife and, you know, I got ready for work just like I did, you know, the day before, and went upstairs and kissed the kids because, you know, I mean, it was early and they hadn't gone to school yet. And,
mm-hmm.
and went out back and grabbed my dog, threw the dog in the back of the truck, and we went to work. And so about 2 hours later, I found myself driving up a canyon that I'd been to hundreds of times before.
Mm-hmm.
It was just kind of my place to unplug from everything. I mean, cell phone service wasn't active up there. And so I make it to this spot that I'd been to, you know, hundreds of times before. And I let the dog out of the back of the truck, and she's running around and just happy, just full life and just happy. And I'm sitting in the front seat of my truck listening to the music and just feeling despair and feeling no self-worth and feeling just having this overwhelming and this over-consuming, you know, thought of what's the point? You know, no one's going to miss me if I'm gone, and
jeez,
those type of things. And so in one brief moment of irrational thinking, I reached over into the center console of my glove box, of my truck, and grabbed my pistol. I loaded it and put it to my head and pulled the trigger. And it was, the end result wasn't quite what I expected, put it to you that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all I got was a click. And so I was, you know, at that time I was mad at myself because it's like, how can you screw this up too? You screw everything else up in life. How could you screw this one up? And so I unchambered the bullet and it landed in my lap and I picked it up and looked at it and looked at the back of the firing pin.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see where the firing pin had actually hit the primer.
Hit the primer.
Yeah, it hit the primer. So I still have the bullet to this day.
Wow.
And
you know, that does, anybody who knows anything about firearms, that doesn't happen. You
it
know?
Doesn't happen. Yeah, like it really physically doesn't happen.
Wow.
I've shot thousands around. Mm-hmm. You know, not as many as a lot of people, but you know, in Utah we hunt and you know do those type of things.
Mm-hmm.
And out of every single gun that I've ever shot, there's only been one time that there's ever been a misfire. And mm-hmm. it just happened to be that time.
Jeez. Now, what do you – and we're all great that you were – or we're all happy that you were unsuccessful in what you were doing, obviously, that day. Most importantly, your family. What do you – Justin, what do you think? I'm not trying to get into a spiritual discussion right now, but what do you think? Do you think that that was somebody looking out for you or something looking out for you?
Well, you know, the religious side of things, I never dog on anybody's beliefs,
mm-hmm.
right? So whether it's, you know, Christianity or whether it's
yeah.
Muslim or whether it's whatever, right? It's everybody has their certain sets of beliefs. My sets of beliefs are, you know, might be a little different than most, but I still think that at the end of the day, you know, we do have a higher power that looks mm-hmm. over us and gives us the opportunity to be in situations where we can learn more about ourselves. And so, you know, having the pistol to my head and having it not go off, it taught me a lot in that small, brief 15 seconds
mm-hmm.
of you know, of the adrenaline and everything that was going through my body. And it was about an hour after the experience. It was, you know, it was a huge realization to me that I was here for something bigger than
mm-hmm.
just, you know, I was here to, you know, to spread the word and to explain to people that, you know, you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
We all go through struggles in life. It's how we overcome them is what builds the character.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. Now, if you could give some advice to somebody out there struggling, and I'm sure you have many, many, many times, in you know, struggling and contemplating ending their life, what would you say to them, Justin? Because usually when you were at a point in your life, thank God it didn't happen, but you were at a point where you were ready to end it all. And it's hard to pull people back from that.
Yes.
You know, so what do you tell people, you know, if you're trying to counsel them? And
well, for me, the biggest thing I like to explain to people is, and let them know, you know, disclaimer all the way through, is I'm not a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the farthest thing from a doctor. What I am, though, is a guy that has had the opportunity to live with a mental illness. And so the two things that I talk about when someone gets into that point of their life of where giving up seems better than anything else, you know, first and foremost, you need to stand up and have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be able to talk to people. You need to, you know, grab friends and family and or coworkers or whoever the people in your life that you trust. Make sure that they're close and talk to them, and because they're going to be your biggest support system. You know, these people are the ones that love you the most and care about your well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I promote a lot on standing up and having a voice and being able to talk about it. If someone isn't, if they don't feel comfortable enough with talking to friends and family, the other huge suggestion is called the local suicide prevention hotline.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talk to these people. You know, it's still here again, having a voice, but you're also speaking to someone that on the other line has no judgment of
mm-hmm.
you. And, you know, I mean, here again, and I'll say it a million times, you know, we're all just trying to push through life the best that we can.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have our own personal struggles and we have our own personal goals. And if we can stand up and have a voice on everything that we do, then we can attract the people that we can lean on.
Mm-hmm.
And what we also find out too is that not only do we find the people that we can lean on, but we find the people that can lean on us.
Mm-hmm.
Being in service of others, man, is the
best. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's the best.
Now, what would you give? Because, you know, I'm in law enforcement. A lot of people that listen to this are in law enforcement. And I don't know if you know this, Justin, but it really is unfortunate that we, as law enforcement, are coming, we're having to respond more and more with people that are suffering with mental illness. I mean, it has skyrocketed in the last decade. And I've been doing this for over two decades. What advice would you give to first responders out there that come into contact with somebody who is suffering, like, you know, bipolar or schizophrenia? I mean, what advice would you give to them?
Well, what I'm pushing for now, and I'm pushing for it pretty hard in every avenue that I possibly can, is to bring awareness
mm-hmm.
first and foremost, right? So if you have an officer or if you have a paramedic that knows of the disorder through a book or through some type of educational purpose, but has never dealt with someone who physically has had it themselves, it's hard to relate to that person. And
mm-hmm.
and so for me, I'm really trying to promote the awareness so that when the first responder shows up and is having to converse and having to try to calm down someone who has, you know, PTSD or schizophrenia or bipolar or any of the gamut of things,
mm-hmm.
that they understand a little bit more about what a mental illness is.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there's still a judgment behind it.
Exactly.
You know, there's still a stigma, and whether you understand it or whether you don't, if you don't understand the side of mental illness and what it's like, then it's hard to put yourself in that person's shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, here again, my advice, and the things that I'm pushing for is to just bring awareness to everybody, to first responders, to family members, to everybody around, that the mental illness is going to be one of those things that is not going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be bigger, and it's going to grow into something that if we don't control it right, then there's going to be some discrimination. There's going to be no tolerance. There's going to be, you know, the stigma is still going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want that. For
yeah.
me, I don't want that.
Well, and it's like you said, I mean, it has to start with awareness, education. Because I don't know if you know this, Justin, you probably do, and I know a lot of listeners do, but the United States correctional system is the largest provider now of mental health services in the country.
Yep.
And it is crazy. I think, and look, I'm a cop, but I think sometimes we're arresting people that we shouldn't be arresting, you know, because they are suffering from mental illness. And I think actually you're not helping them. They actually could be doing more damage by putting them in jail.
No, absolutely. And I couldn't agree with that even, you know, even more, because, you know, if you look back at, you know, when I was 13 years old, And when I was going through that mania phase of mine, if my grandfather would have called the police and had the police involved and made me, you know, go to some type of juvenile detention and...
Oh, it would have been horrible, man.
And basically put me in the system.
Yeah.
Man, I wouldn't be who I am today.
Yeah.
I would have went down a whole different path.
Yeah. Well, let's switch gears a little bit, buddy. What, tell us about this wildly successful professional life, your racing career, because you're owner of Race Pro Tech, right?
Yeah.
And you're an off-road champion. Four-time USRA Series champion, national winner, third overall winner in the Challenge of America Series. Man, you're crushing it. So, tell us a little bit about your professional life, man, and how did you just get to the point where you're at? I mean, you talked a little bit about it earlier, where you just, you know, you're in that creative mindset, but it's amazing, man, your background.
Well, I don't have the concept of quit.
Yeah.
And I know that probably sounds a little, you know, a little goofy to people. But
no, that's any successful entrepreneur.
Yeah, we just, you know, for me, I don't understand the words quit. You know, I understand, you know, struggle, and I understand failure,
mm-hmm.
right? But just because you fell at something doesn't mean that it was bad. And so, you know, for me in my racing career, you know, I've been racing for 26 years now, and I grew up poor. We didn't have much money. We had a couple dirt bikes, and me and my dad would go, you know, ride anytime that we could. And you know, I was married at a super young age, and so, you know, at 17 years old, I had a baby. And then at 18, I started my own company and bought a dirt bike and did, you know, the normal trail riding around the house and, you know, up in the mountains and stuff. And I wanted to try my hand at racing because I love to compete. And I did my first race when I was 18, and I've been doing it ever since, man.
That's crazy, man. And like I said, you're very successful. I actually saw an interview with you where, kind of shifting gears a little bit, but you're tatted up, man. And I got a sleeve on my right arm. So, and you talk about how that's kind of a adrenaline thing, getting tats.
Yeah. It's what's crazy is so one of the biggest life mottos that I have, and it's a lot like when I speak to, you know, the tens of thousands of people that I get the opportunity to speak in front of, it's always like the moderator or someone who's kind of controlling things. It's, you know, they're always asked, they ask me, what is something that you can leave? You know, what words of advice can you leave with someone? And my biggest motto, the biggest thing that I live my life by every single day, from the second that I put my feet on the ground until the second I go to bed, is that anything in life worth doing is worth overdoing.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And the moderation is for those people who don't believe in their abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I did my tattoos, funny story, I didn't have any tattoos when I was 40. And I wanted a tattoo. You know, I'd wanted one my entire life, but never went through it, you know, and actually got one. Well, when I turned 40, I decided that was my time. And it was March 7th. I got my first ones March 7th. And in 365 days, so from March 7th to March 7th, I did 270 hours of work. So
that's crazy, man.
Yeah, I did both sleeves and my entire back, and you know, it's
well, if, like you said, if you're gonna do it, you better go big.
Go big or go home, baby. That's the way it is.
Well, Justin, man, if people want to reach out to you, brother, how do they find you?
You can find me on my website. It's justinpeck.com. We've got a lot of good information there on like mental health and different scenarios, you know, noticing and seeing different traits in children or mm-hmm. or finding traits in your spouse or, you know, things like that. So we've got, you know, a good blog section on that. So there's a lot of good information behind it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can purchase the book there as well.
And you can go on Amazon too for it.
Yep. We can do Amazon as well. We hit the bestseller list 3 weeks after we released the book. So that was an accomplishment for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am so glad, Justin, that you are here today, brother, and you're spreading your message because it's a very, very important message. And I want to thank you for taking the time to come on the show, man.
Well, thanks, Pat. I do appreciate the opportunity.
And take care of yourself, man.
Always do, man. Here again. I'm bulletproof, baby.
All right, brother. Take care of yourself.
All right, see ya.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.